David Slyfield has devoted a lifetime to studying high-performance performers. He's interviewed and profiled every New Zealander who's won an Olympic gold medal in the last 30 years. And he's also gone behind the performance curtain with a number of the world's most successful teams across a whole range of sports, including the sport of sailing, of course. We will come back to David in a moment. Firstly, some of our introductions. My name's Andy Rice, and this week I'm coming to you from Amman at the 49er and NACRA World Championships. And on the other side of the world, looking like he's on his own boat, is Hamish. What are you up to, Hamish?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. The sun's just rising over Waiheke Island here. On the boat again, just enjoying the last of our lockdown in Auckland. Really great to have Sly with us tonight. Your time and morning our time. One of the true legends in Kiwi high performance sport.
Well, let's bring in David Slyfield, aka Sly. Sly, thank you so much for joining us on the call. It's pretty early in New Zealand, and you've got kids upstairs that you don't want to be waking. So, with all of that in mind, thank you very much for getting on the call. And so much to launch into with you. I don't really know where to start, except just tell us how much have you enjoyed, if you have done, how much have you enjoyed working in the sailing world?
Yeah, the sailors I find, I work across a range of sports, but sailing has been one of the main ones that I've worked in. I really enjoy working with in the sailing. There's a really great culture where you've got people who are focused on performance, but at the same time, kind of a relaxed people. And I can dig into that in a bit about why I think that is. The company that you keep amongst sailors is always fun and enjoyable. And I'd have a good time.
Sailors have been known for that.
Yes.
Hamish, tell us what has Sly brought to a team when you've seen his involvement, for example, in Emirates Team New Zealand? What difference does he make?
Yeah, well, I first cross tracks with Dave Slyfield right back in the early 90s when he was making his way at the beginning of his career, and so was I. So we've gone through a lot of transitions ourselves. That was the youth worlds for me as a coach, my first coaching role. And for Sly, he was a physical trainer at that time. And since then, he's reinvented himself, and as we all have, and he's carried on learning. And I think my closest contacts with Dave, with Sly as we call him, have been through the Olympic classes, and obviously with working with Peter and Blair most recent in the last sort of eight or 9 years. So
So,
that comes from.
yeah, no, we just about got you there, Hamish. And Sly, it sounds like you have been through a number of evolutions in your career, but tell us, what was the spark that got it all started for you, and where did your interest in sport come from initially?
I was a club sailor of no great repute, and I sailed through the youth classes of Optimist, P's, Laser for a little bit, Starlings and things, and then I got into windsurfing. I'm dating myself here, but that's when windsurfing first came on the landscape, and did that more as a fun pursuit rather than competitive pursuit. I enjoyed that, the places I could go on my board. But then I stopped sailing, went to university, and almost literally the very next boat that I sailed on was NZL60, so America's Cup boat. So quite different from a single guy on his windsurfer sailing along to being on a boat of, I think in those days, what did we have, 16 crew members that were on those America's Cup boats. When I was at university, I worked part-time in the university gym, and I trained a number of athletes at that time who went fairly well. So it just evolved organically in my career. So helping people across a range of sports, and then people would seek me out, and sailors and things. Through to 2008, I carried on training people's bodies. Because that seemed pretty easy in terms of you do X and Y training, and the improvements are a pretty clear input in, input out. But over time, I've switched more to a global role around people's performance. So I'm really interested in individuals and teams and how they get the best out of themselves, so individually and collectively, and whether that be in a sporting context or in a business context. So more recently, I spend most of my time in the business environment now.
Okay, and what are the common factors that you've observed across sport and business? What human factors apply in all of those areas?
Well, and this is where probably part of with the sailing that I find enjoyable, and sailing is probably the most transferable to a lot of other activities outside of sport. When people conceptualize sport in the main, they often think of the physiological aspects of sport. So your rowers, your swimmers, your runners, and things sort of the things a lot of people focus on at the Olympics. And that is largely a physiology contest. If you prepare the best physiology, and you have, if you're robust enough to deliver it under pressure, then the best physiology will win. Whereas in sailing, physiology is a part of it, but it's only a part component to the overall performance. And fundamentally, sailing breaks down to, it's a decision-making contest. The person who can make the best decisions, both on and off the water. And when I say decisions, not only around the race course, but in your whole campaign, where are you going to invest your time? Because you have to be more effective about where you spend, invest your time. We've all only got the same amount of time leading up to an Olympic Games. So it's making sure you dedicate your energies in the best space. And that's a lot of what I do with campaigns, helping them figure that out for themselves. And why I say that's transferable is because that's kind of life. We've all got the same 24 hours of the day, and you can choose what you do with it. So if you're going to dedicate yourself to a pursuit and you really want to be successful in that pursuit, you have to be very targeted in that space. The other thing that sailing crosses over into life a lot more is that some of the events I've worked with are over and done within 40 seconds at the Olympic Games. It's about expressing 10 years of work in a 40-second window. That's the opportunity you get. Whereas in sailing or competitive sailing, a regatta is raced over days and can span over a week. And so sailors need to be able to balance switching on and switching off, because you can't draw all your energy into that one space. You have to have the ability to continuously perform. And I think that crosses more to life and business, et cetera, where it isn't all about product launch on one particular day. It's about continual improvement and continual excellence.
So when there are sports where your whole career is defined by 40 seconds, that sounds like pressure at the extreme end of sport. So when we talk about pressure in a more sort of a long distance kind of event, like a week-long sailing regatta, do you see that as pressure when you've seen the other kind of pressure in other sports?
So pressure, if you were on the start line in your medal race for the Olympic Games and you're on even points and you've got to make a decision of what time to hit the line and whether to go left or right, there's a fair amount there as well. But again, it's about an athlete getting into the place, if we think of a sailor, where they can make a decision that would be exactly the same as if, for example, in New Zealand, a lot of people sail off Takapuna. So what would you do there if you can bring that mindset across into the Olympics? So you hear this across all the sports. So I've interviewed more than 50 people who've won medals and coaches of people who've won medals. I've interviewed people who've finished fourth at the Olympic Games. But you really need to be able to make a decision based on facts at the time, and be able to park the outcome for all the consequences of that. So you in that kind of space. So the same applies to like an example of a BMXer standing on a 8-meter start ramp at the super ramp at the Olympic Games, looking down at a jump that's 4 meters across, and you have to be first to that jump and a first across the corner, but they need to be able to let go of all of that and be able to think clearly and as I say, just make the decisions on based on the facts of the time. So what they're, what's going on and around them.
So how far have you gone into the science of that side of things? Have you become as adept and expert on the thought processes involved in that as you were on the physical side of the sport earlier in your career?
Well, I'm not a sports psychologist. I did study psychology originally in my career, but we have experts for that who focus all their time on that. And a number of the athletes that I work with use a mental skills coach. Some do, some don't. And it's not a compulsory that you need to. If you think that's how you can get the best out of yourself, there are some brilliant people who can help in that space. But you all, irrespective of if you're working with a sports psychologist, everyone needs to work on their mental skills, both internally and with their coach. And so the way that we focus in the campaigns that I work with, there is a massive reflection process that we use. So one of the hallmarks of the work that I do is that, look, if you go to the Olympic Games, if you think of it like an exam, so all your training, everything you've done is like the study that you bring into this exam. And then you get the exam and you sit the exam and you get in an exam at school, you get a mark, or at the Olympic Games, you get a place. The thing about it is that you cannot change that result. And the reset in the Olympic Games is 4 years you have to wait for. So what you need to make sure is that your study is the best it could have been. And you turn up and see what the exam provides. Everyone else turns up with their best study. And when in that environment, all your weaknesses will be exposed. That's the truth of it. It's you're under pressure, the world's watching, it's the best play the best, and the result will be the truth. So the thing is that instead of waiting till after it's done, when you do the debrief after an Olympic Games or an America's Cup or what have you, you can't change the result. So you need to bring that forward in time and start reviewing on your road to gold. How are we going? And every little example of mini exams that we have, et cetera, which will be regattas. So the great thing about sailing is there's plenty of events that you go through to test yourself, and you have to learn from each of those. So, you know, I phrase it as it's a race to outlearn your opposition. And so continual review and debriefing, et cetera, is a massive part of the work that I do with people.
You still there, Andy?
He's frozen a bit, Hamish. You might take over, mate.
Yeah, thanks, mate. That was a really, really valid description. And certainly, if I had to summarise, you know, the input you've provided to Pete and Blair and other teams that I've been with over the years, it's exactly that. It's that really thorough, continual review and debrief process, and putting those kind of frameworks in place and getting the most out of what the learnings are on the table. So, yeah, you're beautifully phrased. Thanks for that summary. Andy, are you there yet? Might have to move on without him.
If I add one thing to that, Hamish, because there's a couple of interesting stats. So across those 50 people, I asked everyone after they'd finished and won a medal, how much of your medal do you think was won before you entered the Olympic Village? And across all those sports and all those people, it's a 90-10 rule. People say that 90% of it was won in the preparation and 10% in the delivery. And of course, you don't win a medal at the Olympic Village. They don't hand them out to you because you were the best prepared. You've actually got to go out and show people that you are and compete against the best. So you have this. But if I look at 2016, the Rio Games, for New Zealand, we reviewed every athlete who went there. And before they went, they were asked, are you happy with your preparation? Do you think your preparation met or exceeds your expectations of winning a medal? 82% of people said yes going into the games. Ask them afterwards how many people were satisfied with the performance they delivered, and only 53% were. So 47% of people weren't satisfied with what they did. So the gap between the 82%, I'm 82% confident that I'm good going into the games, and less than half saying actually I wasn't good enough. It's like that thing that people say, that something like 80% of drivers say they're better than average drivers. It can't be possible. So what I am alluding to in that statistic is you need to understand on your journey to whatever it is you're preparing for, but if it's the Olympic Games, are you really on track or are you kidding yourself? Because your self-assessment is probably going to tell yourself, oh, I'm doing fine. But what we really want to find out on the way is how are we going? Where are our gaps and weaknesses? I interviewed, in the interviews, I asked people, what are the qualities of a champion? And probably the best four words that anyone ever shared to me, and this person had won multiple gold medals at the Olympic Games, their answer was brutal honesty within yourself. So if you haven't reached that point, as I say, you just will be exposed at the Games. Yeah, so you may as well admit your gaps to yourself earlier on and start working on them. So defensive reasoning and ego and excuses and blame, they're all the enemies of good to great.
Yeah.
I'm back now. I can't guarantee I'll be here the whole time, so thanks for keeping it going, Hamish. And so, Sly, I may have missed the answer to this already, but in terms of preparation and knowing whether you're prepared or not, until you've looked down that ramp of the BMX bike race and it's the final and you've never been under the pressure of Olympic Games before, how can you prepare for a scenario that you haven't actually been in before?
There's a bit of a myth that people say about the Olympic Games, you need to go to one to learn to win one. And that's not true, because about a third of the people who win medals at the Games across a range of sports are first timers. So if you're good enough and you've done the preparation, you can deliver a medal winning performance. The thing about the Olympic Games, doesn't matter if you're in sailing, rowing, cycling and things, the people you're going to race against, you would have been no doubt racing against before. It's all the same people, all experiencing the same situation. The only difference is that it's a special occasion, or it's seen to be, because it's once every 4 years and it is the Olympic Games. So the competition breaks down into the same factors. And if you can get people to learn to follow their processes and routines they've developed before that, and reduce the noise around them or the things that try and amplify the game. So one of the factors we've found in people who underdeliver their performance is they suffer from games amplification, meaning that they make it bigger than God, you know, it's everything. Whereas if you go, this is a regatta, there's great outcomes if I perform well here and I really want to, but it comes back to doing the things that we normally do. So I think of routines and processes and behaviours that you have, that you've already evolved in your campaign. Those routines are like a scaffolding that go around it, or the lights on a runway on a landing strip for a plane coming into landing. And this runway just happens to be the Olympic Games runway. So if you can follow those processes, it will still lead you to the sort of performance that you have prepared. At the Games, about a third of people, as I say, suffer from games amplification and deliver a performance they're not, that is not the one they wanted to do, at least a third to 50%. So your first job is to not put yourself in that category. So we rehearse all of the processes in every event, whether it be your local events, your nationals, World Cups, you know, significant regattas around the world. And every single one of those, we debrief. So for Pete and Blair with Hamish through to Rio, they did 28 events. They won them all. Every time they did a thorough debrief, plus a debrief halfway through the campaign, which was like a master debrief. These guys at that point, they were the market leaders by miles. But yet they're still looking for ways to become better and the gaps that they could see in their own performance. So when they list down, when Hamish, Pete and Blair list down what didn't we do well in this event, each of them will write more than a page of things. And those things you're not doing well are opportunities to become better. They also look at it across the fleet and go, what are other people doing better than us? Sure, we won, but doing this. The Spanish were doing that, so... That they're trying to take those things. So the answer to your question, preparing for that, yes, it is a different environment. We also, when I work with first-time Olympians, we have those people go around and talk to a number of other people who've been there and just get an understanding of what their experience was like. But their experience was their experience. It won't be the same. And look, for Tokyo, that whole Games in the end was completely unique in terms of the environment without speaking. it would be, you know, it's a hard one for people to prepare for by replicating what's gone on in other games, because this one was quite different.
Well, there's so much to dig into there, David, and I've got lots of follow-up questions on that. But I wonder if Tim Herzog would like to come in and ask his question. Tim, are you there to come in and talk directly to Sly?
Sure, I can hop on.
Yeah, nice to see.
Yeah, likewise. Sly, so my question for you is, what do you think distinguishes between good debriefs and the best debriefs, right? Like, I've talked with plenty of Olympians who, you know, they have their debrief routine and maybe they think they're on track or they're on track enough and that they're addressing problems, and yet, you know, the best are doing something different.
Okay, so you need three things to have a great debrief. And Andy, just before everyone jumped online, he'd mentioned about what I think other sports do better. One of the things that, as I say, sailors, to be a great sailor, and if someone's coaching sailors, it's about growing the decision-making capabilities and then reviewing those afterwards. So that's a huge factor. But one of the things that sailing has been short on compared to other sports that I've immersed myself in or been part of is sort of the data and technology side is a little lower. So the facts and information, like, for example, I spent time in NBA basketball and I asked them a question about one of their players, how many shots he takes in a year. And they said, come back tomorrow. We've got all that, because we film every single practice, every single game. And they came back and told me, you know, 75,000. And they could tell me the exact number, whereas you couldn't in sailing tell me how most people probably couldn't tell me how many tacks they practice in a year, etc., or have gone on. Mm-hmm. So it's getting better, the analytics, but we have a lack of data. So the three parts you need for a great debrief is to have some facts. So whether they are data or facts, to have brutal honesty within yourselves about what went on and be able to admit when things weren't good or not. And then you need to have an external perspective. Now, a coach plays an external perspective in that they were off the boat and weren't sure what might have been going on around conversations and mark groundings or situations. So they're somewhat external. And then, for example, when I'm with Hamish and Pete and Blair, I'll chip in with a few other questions because I'm completely external. I might have been asleep over in New Zealand when this thing was going on. So you can ask some questions. And when I talk about that importance of data, let me give you a story. Hopefully Pete and Blair will be happy with this one. So we think going into London, they had the, I can't remember what the event was called, or was it Sail for Gold or so, in Weymouth, lead up to the games, and they finished 14th, and you know, they were emerging athletes challenging for to be on the podium at that point. But and we came back, and after 14th, one of the factors that was different from the from that event was that they chose to use the flag kite, which was a strategic decision to see how it went, because the way it's cut is slightly different and you have to sail slightly different angles. So, you know, they connected the flag kite with being part of the reason for 14th. But we had the debrief, and that was a big factor that came out of it. But I just got our analytics person to run the stats. And in actual fact, they were losing more places upwind than downwind. And I don't think they were using the kite going upwind. So we actually came back to that fact and went, look, really it was easy to see, but it wasn't causal. So this is the stats. It's actually upwind performance we need to dig into more. And, you know, they made some changes and they did win a medal in London. But that's what I mean about, you know, you've got this triangle. You need some sort of evidence. You need your subjective view, and you need to be honest about that. And it helps if you've got a coach or a person outside who can ask good questions and to have you try and triangulate the truth about your performance.
Right, to help with prioritizing.
Yep.
Yep. Thanks. It looks like Andy's frozen again.
Yeah. Hey, Sly, just thinking beyond the actual event itself, the end outcome, and just thinking about the campaign in the beginning, looking at the start of a four-year campaign. I know you've done some really great work with, you know, as an example, Lisa Carrington, when she started off in canoeing. Just talk us through how you go about that process.
Yeah, so people are earlier in their journey. It's you're doing more work with them, understanding them, being clear on what it is. Yeah, people can write down, "Yeah, I want to win a gold medal at the Olympic Games," so they can get clear on their goal. But then about who they are and what their strengths and weaknesses are, and then try. So the self awareness. So most medalists have a high sense of self-awareness about themselves, and you have to understand what you're good at and then what could be better, and then how you're going to close that gap down over time and compared to your opposition or compared to the performance that you determine is going to win a medal. So what we do in the early stages is have that greater understanding, and then what you're going to do is, if you had to figure all that out yourself, that's kind of a random approach. There's tons of people out there in the world who've done similar things, who've had experiences and done this road to gold before. So then you go and connect with people in the spaces where you need to gather more information and talk to them and filter out from their stories the things you can accelerate your learning in. So we have a very... So again, just because it's familiar, and Hamish and I, to Pete and Blair and that London campaign, they spent a lot more time early on going out and having coffee meetings with people and picking their brains with some very targeted questions on areas they needed to improve. Then they'd bring those back in. At that point, they were coached by Jess Vanstone for that campaign. And the four of us would sit around, look at what people had shared with them and decided what we wanted to bring into that campaign and what we were going to discard. Because it has to connect back to how you want to sail or who you are as a person, rather than just because the X person said to do it. If you adjusted to what everyone told you, you'd just be reacting and it would be just a random. So you've got to have your own narrative of where you're going and then filter in what that feedback is or information you're giving. So yes, Hamish, in the early stages, we're looking for that and trying to import knowledge really quickly. And then you're going out and getting the best people to work with you. That's critical. So in order to assess who you want to work with, you've got to understand what they're going to bring to your campaign that complements you. So when Hamish came on board with Pete and Blair for the Rio Games, Pete and Blair had already gone through a process where they identified what the main areas they could improve on from London were. And Hamish was the person who had those skills, knowledge, and he also had the personality that would fit. So then they went out and tried to recruit Hamish to be part of their campaign. So they've done a needs analysis, really, on what the gaps were and who could help with that. So the who and the what they could do. And I've worked with other campaigns where, you know, they might need technical expertise or they might need equipment stuff. So they go and find those people, or they bring them in and pay them as a regatta coach or for a period of a training block and import that knowledge. But it comes back to having that strong sense of identity, understanding clearly who you are and your narrative of where you're going, and then feeding that into it, rather than having someone coach you 1 week and then someone get someone different the next week and you're just like tacking, but actually you're just reaching back and forth rather than heading up towards the top mark, which is where the gold is. So you need to be making these adjustments to your performance and behaviour in small steps and logically. And we divide up the time we have in the campaign at the start by understanding where we think the priorities are and what the opportunities are. And then we make sure the time that we spend on land and on the water is aligned to that. So if it's about equipment development, we're going to make sure, does your diary look like that? If it's on the water and you've got certain aspects you want to work on, then going out for a 2-hour sail is not necessarily going to address that. It's only if it's a 2-hour targeted sail and the specific skills of that session has a purpose. So Tom Ashley is someone, so he won the gold in Beijing and windsurfing. And Tom was really good at this. You know, he would say, I can go and get more out of a 2-hour session on the water than I can see some of my opponents get from sailing all day, because he's clear when he leaves the beach what it is he's supposed to achieve and how he's going to do that. So it's a very intense targeted session. And most of the best people I work with, it's less at the higher level about the volume of work they do, and it's way more about the quality of the work they do. Sure, they do a lot of volume. They work hard. They're not lazy, but it's very targeted.
So I think we're still, probably don't have Andy, but that's incredibly insightful, Sly. And I think that prioritisation, you know, that rings so many bells when I, you know, we've often talked with, and you know, it's funny, the course that we have that you're talking on, it's called Road to Gold, and you know, we're always talking about, you know, polishing the dirty side of the vase and yep. understand, you know, what that dirty side is, that brutal honesty. And you know, I know I do, I'm really clear with some of the things that have gone on in yachting terms, but I'm really interested too to see how you might have asked those questions in another sport, just to give us some perspective, if it's possible. You know, for an example, you know, looking at the campaign 4 years out, we've gone out and we've got the information from the very best in that campaign available and filtered it. We've got a plan now, a 4 year plan of what we want to do. Now, there's what would you do with that 4 year plan before you know started the process? Obviously, you had that 2 year sort of master meeting, but is there a, you know, like, is there a, you've got the plan, the 4 year plan? How do we go from there?
Okay, so just to, I'll probably just build on a few things said before. So with the early stages, thinking about the project as a whole, you're getting clear on what it is you think it's going to take to win and what it takes to win for you and where you sit. So we do some sort of needs analysis or assessment, both about the sport we're doing or the event, and we do it about ourselves, so our strengths and weaknesses, et cetera, what we think the best in the world are doing. We do all that. And then I ask people, now why don't you go and test that with people who know you really well or who are very good at this kind of thing, and just ask them without even, you don't need to show them that, but then you can ask them the same questions and see, does it marry up with what you actually thought with yourself, or were you kidding yourself? So you're trying to get the greatest accurate assessment of where you are now. Then you map out that 4 years, and Hamish, yeah, we chunk that right down, of course, as annual plans, and then there's periods of time. And then sailing, the great thing is you've got regattas that help define chunks of time. So you've got your preparation and then the delivery of each regatta. But I see in the old days, a sailor's plan used to be a calendar that had events written on it. And again, to quote Tom Ashley, he said that, you know, that's not a plan, that's a bus timetable. It just tells you where you're going to be and when. A plan is actually, what are you going to do in each of these chunks of work that make you better strategically? So another campaign that I had the pleasure of working with was Joe and Polly in Women's 470. So they won the gold in London. And so in that plan, I think it was the year or 2 years before, they were in the medal racing final against the Dutch. They were of the World Championships. And I hate to say it, but someone asked me on the eve of that, do I think they'll win the gold medal? There was one race left to go. And I said, maybe, but probably not, because we haven't done anything to do with match racing or medal race scenarios yet. That's in year three of the plan. We're really going to focus on that, and they're going to do national match racing champions, et cetera. And sure enough, they got schooled by the Dutch, who were more experienced, and they came second. But second's great, because it puts a fire under your ass. You know, it's probably better that they had that than won that event. So when it came to the medal race, and they're on equal points with the Brits in London, and I was asked the same question, I was like, I'm fairly confident, you know, they've really done their homework, I think they'll be robust here. And then to carry on with John Polly, I might have gone a bit off track from your question, Hamish, but so they win a gold medal in London, and then they come back and do a big assessment, because they're going to go again and go, actually, we can be better still. And they identified areas. In the next year, they did, between them, they did 100 hours of mental skills work with a professional in that space. And it wasn't because they were mentally weak at all. They just recognised a few places they could do better. So you've got the reigning gold medalists who are going, actually, we're going to invest a whole lot in this space, because that's what they identified for was the next iteration. And come Rio, most of you probably don't have an insight of what happened in the women's 470 there. But Joe and Polly got disqualified in one of the races. They had an OCS, and then they got disqualified again. So they had two DSQs, and you got a card one of them. So the unique thing about sailing, of course, is you get this mulligan where you can throw one away and then your back's against the wall. But once you got two of them, you're carding a pretty big score. And they won the silver medal in Rio. And personally, when they talk about it to me, they say they're more proud of the silver than the gold. And I think they're the only Olympic campaign that's ever won a medal at the Games with two DSQs. So the other scores were that good. But what that shows is the strength in their mental resilience that they did, that they didn't crumble after having a couple of bad results. You know, Ben Ainsley, similar in Athens. I remember that, you know, he was a DSQ in one race, or it was a bit of a bogus protest, and then had another bad result. So after day one, his opponents probably thought he was out the back door, and he fought his way back, in his case, to the gold medal. Hamish, sorry, I waffled a little bit there on the stories, but the other thing that I want to share with you is that we use a mantra in the campaign: it's simple, complex, simple. So when you look at when you watch people, and let's just say we talked before those BMX, so Hamish mentioned I've worked with kayakers, I've worked with rowers, I've worked with cyclists who have won medals at the Games and things. You look at it from the outside, and let's say we're looking across at cycling, and it's a man or a woman on a bike going around in circles on a track, all right? It looks pretty basic to us. There's no water splashing over. There's no opponent trying to call a port starboard on you in a cycle race. It's just who can go the fastest around that. So it looks very simple to you. But, of course, once you break down cycling and get into it with all the technology and things, it can be incredibly complex and the splits and times you've got to do if you're pursuiting in the zero. And so to the outsider, any sport kind of looks simple. We're just doing this. And then, as you know, when you're immersed in it, whether you're coaching it, whether you're doing it yourself, it gets really complex. And so what we do in a campaign is we break it down into all the components and decide what we want to do. But we make sure when we get to the delivery phase, we've brought it back into the simple realm again. Because no performance at the Olympic Games in any sport comes out of being complicated. One of the questions I ask all the medalists is, what did their coach say to them before they went out and raced for gold? And the messages the coach shared were incredibly simple, and they're mainly just the key reminders plus a bit of reassurance or encouragement. And because, you know, when you're going out to race for gold, you can't remember a lot of things. You just have to remember the main things. So the simple, complex, simple. And when I work with athletes in campaigns, if they're starting to talk really complicated and we're now near a regatta or competition phase, it's like I'll just draw that little picture and say, which one of these are you in? You're in the simple, complex, or simple? And if you're in the complex, you're not in the right space to deliver. You have to be able to have a clear head and just do the main things and let all your preparation go and trust it. The other part about the journey, whether it's at the start or end, I mentioned about the start with your self-assessment and checking that in against people who should be qualified to either know you or the event. The other thing going into the Games, if I speak back to Andy's question earlier, when you haven't been before. So I worked with Hamish, or Andy mentioned Lisa Carrington, who's a kayaker from New Zealand, who's been incredibly successful. So she's won gold medals in the last three Olympics, and now she's the most successful kayaker I think there's ever been, certainly female kayaker. But going into London, she'd never been to the Olympic Games before. She was fairly young, and her coach had never been to the Olympic Games before. So you had an incredibly novice kind of combination who were incredibly good. So what I got them to do was write down how they planned to deliver that performance, how they planned to move from Europe to the Games, what they were going to do, how it was going to go. And then I worked with the coach over and over, and he wrote iterations till he went, no, this is what we're going to do, and this looks spot on. And then I asked him who are the people he thought might be able to test that, and he identified some brilliant people, whether coaches or people who've been to the Games and things, not just in his sport but outside. And then we took that plan around. It was seven different people. And every single one of those, I went to a lot of the meetings, pointed out one or two things that he hadn't thought of or that weren't right about what they were doing or that could have been a problem. So then he adjusted that plan so he could deliver, put Lisa in a good space. She didn't have to worry about any of that. And then after the Games, he reflected. He went, man, if I didn't do that, I would have done so many things or had not considered a number of factors that we needed to build into our campaign. So the thoroughness of testing your thinking beforehand is really important. But what he did there is he protected the athlete, so it wasn't complex. For her, it was simple. I just got to go out and paddle and do the training program. He was the one taking on the complexity and then making it. To her, it just seemed, after the Games, everything just, she was sort of, in fact, her statement was, everything just kind of fell into place But behind the scenes, there was a coach who had contrived to make it so it felt perfect to her. So, you know, kept away all the noise, all the clutter, everything, all the media, had just put a little nice little buffer around all of that.
Go for it, Andy.
Sorry, Hamish. Yeah, David, I've just listed in the chat box the teams that you've worked with in various different sports. And I'm just wondering, there can't be many people that have had the opportunity and the privilege to get across so many sports in the way that you have. With that in mind, what do you see as sailing's strengths, but maybe more importantly, its weaknesses? What can we learn from the approach of other sports?
I'd say that in Olympic sailing, and maybe you're people who are in other nations listening to this will go, well, we're far more advanced than you are in New Zealand. But I just saw the analytics and the data stuff that your information you've got coming off boats or being able to analyze performances being, if I just contrasted it to all those other sports, and even in America's Cup, obviously in the Cup stuff, you've got a ton of information. I think when I was back in the day with Team New Zealand, that's a long time ago, technology, I think the analysts told me we had 1 million individual pieces of data per second coming off the boat. But all of them, the motor racing, even the rugby, the tracking and stats they have around the performance around the field, basketball I mentioned with traveling with like Tour de France teams, you know, they've got all the power data off everyone's bikes, all those things. So that's probably a gap that I know that many technology companies are trying to resolve and many nations are doing with boats. You've got to make sure if you're going to get a lot of data that you can be baffled by the bullshit as well. So you have to make sure that that's just, you've got your subjective view, as I said, in that triangle that the coach and athlete are there. You don't want to overcomplicate it, but if you've got information, it's useful when you do want to use it. So that's probably one of the areas. Historically, sailing was probably weak in the physical preparation. Back in the day, as I say, sailors like to have a lot of fun, and they may not have prioritised their physical prep. I don't see that as being much of a problem. Most sailors now are completely professional about how they prepare. I see them working out in the gym, and they're a lot better than back in the day when I used to help people with that at the highest level. So those are the areas. And however, the parts that again to reinforce the strength is that to be a great sailor, if your coach was trying to plan everything for you and say, I'm just going to tell you how to do it, it's not going to work because you've got to go out there and race and make these decisions in the moment. So the one thing that sailing does is it grows great decision makers, grows great human beings, because you have to be able to think for yourself. You can't get to the top in sailing unless you're clever. So it doesn't necessarily need, I've never met a dumb sailor. And I mean that you don't have to be academically smart. Like one of the sailors that I worked with for a long time and they won Olympic medals and many world championships. I asked them once, I said, what would you have been if you weren't a sailor? And he replied, I would have been a juvenile delinquent. And it was kind of both true, but he wouldn't have because he was incredibly street smart. He wasn't necessarily a school, but he didn't like school. But you have to figure out how to get clever in your performances. So that's where I think sailing has it above other sports. I go into a lot of other cultures and they're basically, the coaches are trying to tell or control a lot more. And in some sports you can, like in, if you rugby, they can send messages to the trainers on the field. So there's a bit of that, but then you take it to the nth degree in basketball where the bloody coach is every 5 seconds stopping the game and you watch them, they're drawing complicated plans and giving their players direction. And I didn't have a sense when I spent time in those professional sports in America that they really grow individuals. And one of the saddest things I kind of heard in one of the basketball franchises is they said when an NBA player retires, they don't know how to cook their breakfast, but they know how to make good choices off the menu, because they get fed all the time and things, and they don't have to think for themselves, even though it's quite a fluid game. And, to extrapolate that out, what happens in life, within 2 years, I think it is, of that, 70% of them either have a drug problem, they're broke, or they've got a gambling problem, or they're divorced. One of those four things, 70% within 2 years. So what I do see is a lot of sailors who finish their sailing career and go on to have successful careers or very enjoyable lives because they've kind of learned how to think And you have to, as I say, it's fundamentally chess on water. It's a decision-making game, and that thinking is transferable to all sorts of spaces. And I encourage a lot of the sailors when they retire to lead programs or to even be entrepreneurial. I think as they're really well suited to that, they can run projects because you've got massive logistical aspects you've got to run, financial aspects, equipment aspect, you know, you've got equipment and technology, physical. Many of them don't, some of them don't go that well in office-based jobs when they retire. Hey, Hamish.
Exactly. Nice summary, Sly. Brilliant. Brilliant insights. Fantastic.
David, sorry I'm ducking in and out. We thought your internet was going to be the problem. Turns out it's mine. If someone wants to take on someone like you for their own campaign, where do they find someone like you? And are you available? Are you on the market?
I haven't planned to be. As I mentioned, my latest, I at the moment if have very enjoyable work, which is interesting, working with New Zealand's largest company. So that's Fonterra, they're a dairy exporter, and helping them inside their organisation change some things around. Just they have a big focus on efficiency, which every great company should have. But some of the things that athletes do well, even in sailing, how we do things well, I've been helping them figure that out for themselves. So setting in place a program there. So since late last year, that's been my main focus, and I may help a couple of people towards the games, but we'll just see. At the moment, I've got plenty on my plate. But what you really want to do, I would encourage everyone, what I really think is cool about the coaches I've worked with, and I would say this about Hamish, I mentioned Jez Fanstone before, there's Nathan Hanley, New Zealand's great coach, Jeff Woolley, people like that. Most of them aren't really massively ego-driven or protective around their campaigns. They're really comfortable about their athletes going out and seeking different knowledge and information. And many of the athletes that I work with in sailing and things will have a group of mentors, and I would describe myself as on a campaign as being like on a board of directors. So you're on the outside, they make all the decisions. You don't have a decision-making authority, but you ask them good questions and help them identify gaps, risks, and opportunities. And I see the sailors going out and identifying people locally, nationally, internationally, who they can have a chat with that help advance their performance. And so what I'm saying is that all the people on this call, if they want to get better, the likelihood of someone just locally who's really great, you might be able to reach out to other people. I've had great success in the athletes I work with about reaching out to people and saying, would you mind giving a bit of time? Now, Hamish reached out to me on this call. Would you mind an hour? The thing about athletes, particularly who you're not competing against anymore, they're willing to share their knowledge and information. So seeking, identifying those people and asking them it's what I suggest you would do.
Okay, well, Andreas has got an interesting question, which I will come to in a moment, but one of the things that Hamish talks about on Road to Gold is diversifying your sailing experience. So if you're focused on the 49er, you still become a better sailor in the 49er by doing different types of sailing. And then there's cross-training that Hamish also talks about, whatever that may be, mountain biking, whatever that may be. I know time is always an issue, and we've got very limited amounts of it. But what about... what would the Uber athlete find if they were able to spread themselves across the other sports that you've studied? How much better a sailor would they become if they tried to compete across the other sports that you've worked in?
I don't know about competing. And many of them do other sports, and they love their mountain biking and cycling, or they'll go and do things. I know many of the coaches and things have spent time around, like going, for example, New Zealand has an incredibly successful rowing program. And so I know some of our yachting coaches have gone and spent time there and just picked up little small things that they do about the way that they prepare. So I always think there's things to learn from all different sorts of spaces. But probably in sailing, do is that sailing is an awesome sport, and that very much encourage people to do other events to the point where, as long as they're not a massive distraction. And you mentioned that story about John Polly. I mentioned before, you know, saying they're building match racing nationals and keelboats into their performance. You know, athletes getting out and doing exciting, fast events, falling moths and wasps and things like that and stuff, that where time speeds up, we've got shorter time to make decision-making. If you come back then into your 470 or something, it's going a little bit slower, or you've worked with fin sailors or going a lot slower, you've got more time and space to do that. So just picking up those different aspects. It's one thing that's sailing within your sport, there are so many different variations of it. Just as cyclists will often do the cross codes of road cycling and mountain biking if they're track cyclists that advance their skills.
David, you started the call by saying that you were a fairly average standard club sailor very early on when you first got into sport. I'm just wondering, with everything you've learned and studied and the people that you've worked with so closely, how do you think you'd be if you took some of those principles back to sailing and put yourself back into club racing again? Do you think you could win the Sunday morning race now?
Winning isn't something I've really been driven at. When I hear some of the athletes talk about how focused they are on this, what I know is I probably don't want to do it that way. You know, it takes a huge amount of
dedication and joy.
So if I took some of them, I'm not claiming that I could just take a list and start my life working with people who want to do great things. I'm not that way inclined myself. I do mostly in Hamish and I mountain bike and things. And it's not hugely important to me whether or that, but I'm not driven by that, and I never wanted to be the best cyclist on the planet or the best sailor, etc. So it's kind of ironic that I work in a space where tons of people I work with have been number one, and I think that's really cool because that's what they wanted to do. And so you can enjoy sailing for many different aspects, except, you know, it doesn't have to be the road to gold. I'm assuming most people on this call, by the very name of it, that is what they want to do. But so going back to my former self at 10 or 12, there's tons of stuff I've learned. I'd be a way better sailor. I don't know whether internally, whether as I moved through the classes, I would really have the drive to the desire to want to put my whole life into trying to win an Olympic medal or do X and Y. And it was just hugely fortuitous as well. As I say, I actually got to sail with, so when we campaigned in Valencia in Team New Zealand, we didn't have the budget to afford two sailing teams, so I sailed every day on the B boat as a floater, you know, and but then I crossed over and sailed on the A boat most of the times because I was in the same role as Grant Dalton at that point. He had so many meetings, and you know, there was me going, wow, it's like I'm playing with the halfback in the All Blacks, and you can't do that as a regular. I'm just a club player at best. And that's pretty cool to see how those people do it, but seeing the level they take it to and the ability and capability, I'd sort of made a decision early in my life and it was the right one that wasn't for me. And I'd just been so fortunate to witness it firsthand, rub shoulders and listen to all the communication and all these sports, et cetera. But I think it has to be an internal desire that you really want to do it. And if you do, and I test that with people, then go for it and do it well. If you're going to do something that you really want to do, you have to do it well if you want to achieve the ultimate, which is to be one of the best people on the planet at it.
Sly, we've got an interesting question here from Jan Chu. Jan, I wonder if you can come in and ask this question directly. I'd love to hear the answer on this.
Just like you say about transferring from sailing to life, you know, in life we've got multiple different things even day to day at work, but you know, like you say, like we've seen Pete and Blair do excellent in multiple different things that they do. Maybe any tips on that, like how, you know, being excellent in everything as well, or how to plan for that?
Okay, well, it's hard to be excellent at everything, and Pete and Blair certainly aren't as well. And It's kind of like the saying that if everything's important, then nothing is. So you want to figure out what's important to you and make sure you align yourself to that with your time and your energy. And as I say, at this stage of my life, what's important to me is having good friends and my family and things, and competing or being the best in business or anything isn't the be all and end all. That transference, one of the things that happens in life is that life happens every day, and that's awesome about it. But sport does have very defined deadlines. As I used that exam example before, you can't shift the exam date. So it really drives your attention to being ready, because if you're not ready on the start line of the first race of the Olympic Games or day one of the America's Cup, it's too late. So what I do when I see people in business, a lot of them, they just fill their calendar up with stuff. Like their week gets so busy with a whole lot of meetings, and it's just meeting after meeting after meeting, and eventually people burn out. And I don't see an athlete's calendar being arranged that way. It's arranged by, hey, these are the important things I've got to do in the week, the month, the block or the year, and let's build backwards from that and work towards it. But in business and in other aspects of life, we're just busy getting to the next thing. And so what we're doing then is reacting all the time rather than responding and rather being proactive. So if you take a bit of time to figure out what it is you want to do, and it could be in the sailing realm or elsewhere, and then try and set milestones into that. So by this point, I want to do this or that. That's where sport's great about achieving a goal, because you can build stepping stones into it, both by testing yourself, by entering events, or by even saying by this date, I want to have done this type of training in this March and here, so you can quantify it. So that's probably one of the transferable aspects from sport in general into life, in that goal setting and timelines are much clearer in sport. And when some people retire and they don't carry over that behavior, some athletes get really lost, right? Because your life's been governed by this great goal and it's led to structure. And then you finish the Olympic Games, you get on the booze, you have some Maccas, you do this and that, and you're hanging out and enjoying your success or commiserating that it wasn't what you wanted it to be. But after a while, they find, well, I'm kind of lost now. I don't have a purpose to get up for every day and things. So it's about finding a different purpose or the space. And so it's probably a nice little segue from where we started when you asked about the beginning. So one of the best things one of the athletes shared with me is he said, Don't retire from something, retire to something. So what's the next thing? And again, I'm speaking to an audience where yachting is a sport you can have for life, and there's Hamish on his boat. He may not be interested in sailing that boat faster than the guy around in the next bay, but you can carry on still getting pleasure from your activity. Cycling's another one where often people do that. But Jesus, rowers and swimmers, when they retire, I don't see them going out recreationally rowing or swimming up and down a pool for fun. Most of them don't do it ever again. So you're in a cool sport where you can apply it in different ways, and then, you know, our kids get into it and things like that. So it is a sport for life. That's one of the cool things. But you can take those life skills that you got out of it and put it into other spaces. And I think sailors, and by their very nature of planning and that, as I say, they're generally pretty entrepreneurial. They're pretty innovative. It's an innovation sport as well. Hopefully you're doing that innovation within the rules or the boundaries that each class allows. And so you can just keep doing, applying those skills across into life.
Sly,
that sounds a pretty nice place to summarize the end. I think it's what you got to say, Andy.
Pretty much, yes. There was another question from Andreas, which I think we'll address it in another way on another occasion. But David, you've covered some amazing ground today, and I love the 3 points that you brought back to Tim Herzog's question about the best debriefs. You need facts and data, you need brutal honesty, and you need that external perspective. And I found that absolutely fascinating. And I think coaches like Hamish are incredibly brave to allow people like you to look over their shoulders at their campaigns as well. It's part of that whole cycle of brutal honesty. David, to jump on this call and help us out with this Q&A has been absolutely fascinating. I'm going to listen back through the recording so I can hear what I missed. But thank you so much for that. We'd love to get you back on for another one of these sometime. Any final thoughts from you, Hamish, on the time that you've spent working with David over the years?
Oh, Dave's a legend. You know, he's the best at what he does, and he will continue to be. And he forgot to say he's actually really good on the bike as well. And he every week at on our little weekly group ride at Puhoi, he takes me apart. So, yeah, he's just an all-round good bastard.
Well, I don't quite know you well enough to say that too, Sly, but I'm sure you are. And thank you again for joining us. We are going to have an America's Cup coach on next week. We look forward to talking to Philippe Presti then. But Sly, from all of us, from Hamish and me, thank you so much for your time. Thanks to all our questioners, and we will see you again sometime next week. We'll reveal the details soon. Have a great week, and we'll see you for next week's Q&A. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Hamish. Thank you, everyone.